From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, jazz drummer Paul Motion. He first made his mark in Bill Evans' trio, along with bass player Scott LaFaro, and was featured on the now historic 1961 Evans recordings at the Village Vanguard. Motion also recorded with Keith Jarrett and Paul Blay and leads his own bands. He has a new recording with Bill Frisell and Joe Lovano. Also, the first season of the 1970s TV sitcom The Odd Couple is now out on DVD. Playwright Neil Simon will tell us about creating the characters of Oscar and Felix. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Private Fears in Public Places, the new film by the 84-year-old French film director Alain René. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest is the drummer Paul Motion. History has shaken him out as one of the greatest drummers in all of jazz, a select group that would include, say, Max Roach and Roy Haynes, wrote Ben Ratliff in the New York Times. Will Friedwald wrote in the New York Sun, quote, "Mr. Motion made history at the Vanguard in 1961 as the drummer with the Bill Evans Trio, whose live album at that already legendary 7th Avenue basement defined a dynasty of piano players. Mr. Motion then helped two other outstanding pianists, Paul Blay and Keith Jarrett, put their trios on the map. Lots of drummers are about power and energy. Mr. Motion is about supporting a soloist," unquote. Terry spoke with Paul Motion last year. Let's start with a track from Paul Motion's latest recording, Time and Time Again, with guitarist Bill Frisell and saxophonist Joe Lovano. This is the Thelonious Monk composition, Light Blue.
How important are drum solos to you?
Not very important.
Why not? Because they're so often for the drummer, like, that's the showpiece, and that's where they get to really, like...
I'm not a showpiece drummer. I don't know. I listened to an interview recently with Kenny Clarke, and he said the same thing that I feel. He wasn't into solos that much either, and I'm not either. I feel like I'm an accompanist. It's my thing to make the other people sound good as they can be. And I feel like I should accompany them and I should accompany the sound that I'm hearing and make it the best that I can do.
Do you feel that you've sat through a lot of boring drum solos over the years?
No. But, I mean, there were drummers that played great drum solos. Chick Webb, for instance. Great drum solo. Buddy Rich played great drum solos. So did Gene Krupa. So did Shelly Manne. A lot of drummers played them, but I don't know. I'm just not into it.
Well, I want to play another track. This is Evidence, mm-hmm. which is a Thelonious Monk composition. And
yeah.
Before we hear it, I want to say you played with Monk very briefly early in your career.
Yeah, I did. And also that track that you're going to play is going to be a drum solo, which I just said I don't like to do.
Right. Well.
But that's fine. That's great.
This is the exception okay. that proves the rule, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I did play with Monk a little bit. I was lucky.
So what if anything, do you feel like you learned from playing with him?
I learned how to listen. Because when I played with him, I really wasn't that familiar with the music, with his music. It was back the first time was in the mid-50s, and the reason I got to play with him was because I went to hear him play. It was in a club in the village here in New York, and the drummer was supposed to be Arthur Taylor. And he wasn't there. He didn't show up. And the promoter of the concert was a man named Bob Reisner, who had seen me around town playing drums. He said, "Paul, Arthur Taylor didn't show up, man. If you want to go home, get your drums, you could play with Monk." So I ran home, got my drums, came back, and played with Monk that night. And Thelonious paid me $10. I was thrilled to death. But I didn't know the music that well, so I just, you know, just gritted my teeth and did the best I could. The next time I played with him was in 1960 in Boston. I played for a week. But I really didn't know that music. So you say, what did I learn? I learned how to really listen and try to do my best to keep the time, to not get lost, to do the best that I could, and to really listen to the music and try to learn from it.
Did he give you any advice?
No.
No suggestions of what he wanted from you?
No. He didn't say much. One time I did say, we came off the stage after one of the songs and one of the sets, and I said to Thelonious, I said, "Gee, you know, I'm sorry. I think maybe I might have rushed the tempo on one of those tunes." He said to me, "If I hit you upside your head, you won't rush." So I paid attention to that. I was very careful after that.
Okay.
No, he didn't say much.
Well, this is.
But one time he did get up and dance when we were playing, so I thought that I did okay.
Did he dance like in a spinning around?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like how I'm sure you've seen him do that.
And
people have seen him do that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So that meant, you know, to me that meant that the music was happening, he was enjoying it, and I was doing okay. That made me feel good.
Okay, well, this is the Monk composition Evidence on Paul mm-hmm. Motion's CD, which is called Garden of Eden. Drummer Paul Motion from his CD, Garden of Eden, and that was Thelonious Monk's composition, Evidence. Let me ask you about your formative years. When you were young, I guess this is maybe when you were in your teens, that you studied with mm-hmm. Bill Gladstone, who was the Radio City Music Hall percussionist?
Oh, right, yeah. Uh-huh.
How old were you, teens?
No, it was later.
20s?
Yeah, early 20s.
So I read that he was famous, but what was he famous for? What was his thing?
He had a system of playing where he used his fingers almost more or as much as he used his arms and his wrists and his hands. He could do amazing things, just hardly. I mean, if you watched him play, you'd think that he was hardly moving. He's just playing with his fingers. I mean, controlling the drumsticks with his fingers. And playing incredible stuff, like really a strong, powerful strokes. I mean, he was something else. He had that system. He had developed it. I mean, it was pretty hard for others to adapt to that system. Shelly Mann studied with him, too. He was sort of I think he kind of copped that style somehow. But it was hard. I mean, the principle was, like, if you're bouncing a ball, the closer you get to the floor with the ball, the less you're moving your hand. And that was the principle of his thing with this, using his fingers.
So did you learn how to do that?
I tried. But I never could do it as well as he.
No, did he play like a showbiz type of drumming?
Sure. I mean, he was a drummer at Radio City Music Hall for I don't know, lots of years, maybe 10, 15, 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. And I heard that people used to go just to watch him. He was so amazing.
Paul Motion, speaking with Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with jazz drummer Paul Motion.
Pretty early in your career, you played with the pianist Bill Evans, I think. You played with him in various groups and in various settings. How did you first meet him?
I met Bill, I guess it was pretty soon after I got out of the service, the military service. He was in the Army around the same time that I was in the Navy. And I guess it was around mid-50s, and I used to go to the Union Hall here in New York looking for a gig, looking for to hear what's going on, if there are any gigs around, any jobs. I'm looking to work. And I overheard someone say that clarinet player Jerry Wald was having auditions, and he was putting a band together to take on tour. So I found out where it was, and I went to the audition, and there was Bill Evans, who also went to the audition, and I heard him play, and I really liked what I was hearing, and I got to audition. Bill got to audition, and we both got the gig, and that's how I met him. That was the first time I met him. And we got the gig, and we went on tour with Jerry Wald. We played around New England. We went to play at an Army base in Puerto Rico. I can't remember how long that tour was. It probably wasn't too long. But that's how I met Bill. That's when I met Bill first.
So after meeting Evans at an audition and playing with him in various settings, you and Evans and the late bass player Scott LaFaro had a trio that became quite famous and quite important. It was a band that was like very kind of quiet and subtle and famous for having three musicians play as equals, so having a lot of interplay between them that wasn't just a pianist with two accompanists. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you actually talked about? Did you talk about having that approach, of having a trio of equals? Because that's how it was seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, that's what happened. I mean, we didn't talk about it, but that's what the result was of us playing like that. Nobody played like that before. I think we were probably the first or one of the first groups to do something like that. Before that, it was always like the pianist with bass and drum accompaniment. And that just happened that way. I think it was because of the three of us, the three individual players who played the way that we played. And when we played, that was the result. That's what happened. We didn't talk about it that much. We really didn't.
Because the band was quiet and subtle and played a lot of ballads, did it limit what you could play as the drummer?
I never thought of it as a quiet setting. I mean, maybe that's the way people conceive it now and listen to it, but...
Well, there's so many ballads, like on the Vanguard sessions. There's so many ballads on it that,
That's true. That's true. Someone told me recently the record company, I don't know what record company by now, but that all that stuff from the Vanguard was released in a box set
exactly
the way we played it, with all the outtakes and there's even one take where we stop playing and you hear people talking and all of that. I wonder what's on that.
Well,
I've never heard it.
I have it right in front of me.
Oh. So, I mean, are there all ballads in that or mostly ballads and slow things?
Well, it's a mix of things, but there's a lot of ballads on it. My Man's Gone Now,
okay.
Detour
okay.
Ahead, My Foolish Heart,
right.
Some
okay.
Other Time.
Okay.
So, yeah. So on the liner notes to that box set that was recently reissued of the Village Vanguard recordings from 1961 with you, Bill Evans, and Scott LaFaro, the producer of the session, Oren Keepnews, writes the liner notes. And he describes Bill Evans as having had low self-esteem. Did you think of him that way? And he seems to think it affected his approach to recording and his discomfort in actually like arranging a recording date. And Keepness says one of the reasons why he wanted to record live, one of the reasons why Keepness wanted to record live at the Vanguard is that, you know, Evans seemed uncomfortable about recording, and this would be a way of just kind of getting it done without scheduling a separate recording date and making him comfortable.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of true because, well, first of all, Bill was really particular about any recording. If the result wasn't top-notch, if the result wasn't really great and satisfying for him, he wouldn't want to put it out. He wouldn't want to release it. I'm sure that he would be against a lot of this stuff that's being released now, second takes, outtakes, and all that stuff. And he did sometimes think of himself as not really playing great. I remember one time we were playing at the Vanguard, and we were playing something, and it was really good, and it was moving along, and it was great. And all of a sudden, it seemed like it took a nosedive, like he just didn't feel like playing anymore or something. And after the set, I asked him what happened. I said, man, how come that happened during that tune? Like it just kind of stopped. He didn't stop playing, but it seemed like you weren't into it anymore. He said, oh, I heard some people laughing at the bar. He said, I thought they were laughing at me. And another time he said to me, gee, I don't know if what I'm doing is real. He says, sometimes I think I'm a phony. So he did say things like that, which would make you think that he had low self-esteem. But, you know, that was really early on, and I don't know what, I didn't play with him after like the mid-60s. I don't know what he was like after that.
At least during part of the time that you played with him, Evans was addicted to heroin. Did that complicate your personal and musical relationship?
Yeah, I quit.
Because of that?
I quit playing with him. I couldn't stand seeing him destroying himself and the music. It wasn't like that in the beginning.
So you saw him change?
Yeah. And I quit. I left him in California. I'd kill anybody that would do that to me.
That would do what to you?
But leave me in the middle of a tour, just quit and go home. That's what I did.
Was there something that was the last straw?
The music was going downhill. You were saying before about soft and all of that. I mean, the music was getting like that. I was playing with brushes, and it just seemed like I couldn't play soft enough. It was just like, I felt like I was playing on a pillow or something. And the music was just, I mean, it just wasn't happening for me, man. I said, Bill, man, it's not happening. I have to go home. I can't do this anymore.
And he
begged me to stay, you know, because, I mean, he had a tour to do. I think he went to Europe for the first time after that. And I left, man. I paid my own way. I went home.
Well, let me play something that you recorded with Evans. And Scott LaFaro. This is from those Village Vanguard sessions from the recent box set that was released. And I thought we'd hear My Foolish
Take
Heart.
One, I hope.
this is the take that was released.
Okay.
Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
No, go ahead and play it.
Okay, here it is. Thank you. My Foolish Heart, recorded at the Village Vanguard in 1961. Bill Evans at the piano, Scott LaFaro bass, and my guest Paul Motion on drums. Shortly after this recording, Scott LaFaro died in a car accident. He skidded into a tree and apparently died instantly. Was this the first time you lost a musician friend so suddenly?
No. I remember when Clifford Brown and Richie Powell were killed in a car crash earlier than that. I was in the mid-50s sometime. And that was sort of the first time that, well, I wasn't close to those guys, but I knew them and I heard them play live. And that was the first time that I sort of lost any musical friends.
What impact did it have on you to lose these people and to see them like die in a car? And let's face it, musicians are on the road all the time.
Yeah, no, it was just it was a shock. I don't know about impact. It was a shock.
Paul Motion, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. From 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Last King of Scotland, starring Forrest Whitaker, now on DVD. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children. On the web at covertheuninsured.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our interview with drummer Paul Motion. Also, creating the iconic characters Oscar and Felix. The TV version of The Odd Couple is out now on DVD. We'll hear from Neil Simon. And David Edelstein reviews the new French film, Private Fears in Public Places. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Let's get back to our conversation with drummer Paul Motion. He leads the Paul Motion Band, as well as a trio that features saxophonist Joe Lovano and guitarist Bill Frisell. Their latest CD is called Time and Time Again. Motion was the drummer in the Bill Evans Trio from 1959 to 1964. When we left off, Terry Gross and Paul Motion were talking about the now historic Evans recordings at the Village Vanguard, with Motion and bass player Scott LaFaro. LaFaro died in a car accident a couple of weeks after those recordings were made.
You know, you talk about the Village Vanguard recordings with Bill Evans and Scott LaFaro a lot. I prefer, everyone says that's great, those are great. But the first record that Bill and I did with Scott was something called Jazz Portraits. I really like that. I think I prefer that to the Vanguard record. And that was a studio recording. It wasn't a live recording.
What's your favorite track from that?
I like Witchcraft. I also like Come Rain or Come Shine. And I guess one of the reasons why I really like it and I thought it was really well done was because we just finished playing for 2 weeks at a club called The Showplace in Greenwich Village. And we did that, and we did that recording right after that. So we had been playing together for quite a while, and then we went into the studio to do that recording. Autumn Leaves is on there. That's a great record.
Why don't we hear a track from that record?
Sure.
Okay, so this is Bill Evans at the piano, Scott LaFaro bass, and my guest Paul Motion on drums. When you played with Evans, and when he was addicted to heroin, I could just see how you would be, and anyone close to him would be, in a really awkward spot. I mean, there were probably times when he was really strung out and felt that he couldn't play without getting a fix. And so that puts you in the position, you're going to help him get it? You're going to give him money he might need or help drive him to his connection or whatever? And if you do, the word enabler didn't exist then, but I'm sure the idea did. I mean, it just strikes me you must be in a really awkward spot of either watching him being unable to play or helping him do something that you knew was bad for him so that he could play.
No, I never did that. I never thought about helping him get high. Never.
You mean that would have been out of the question?
I was never, well, first of all, I was never asked, and if I was, I probably would say no. Mm-hmm. Yourself. But there was one time when we were playing in Washington, D.C., and the bass player at the time was Jimmy Garrison, and we were supposed to play for 2 weeks. And I think we ended up playing only one night or only two nights. And one night in particular, we were on the stage, and Jimmy and I were waiting for Bill to start playing, and Bill was just sitting at the piano. He wasn't playing, and all of a sudden, he stood up, and he walked to the front of the stage to the microphone. The place was packed. It was full of people, and Bill said, made an announcement to the people, and he said, you know, I don't feel like playing right now. It's just, can you understand that? And they all applauded. And they were all for him. And we walked off the stage. And I believe the reason for that was that Bill didn't have the drugs he wanted to have. And at the end, and then Jimmy and I said, well, what's happening, man? What's going on? He said, I want to go back to New York. And we said, well, man, we're supposed to play here for 2 weeks. And Bill said, I don't care. I just want to go back to New York. And finally, we, after talking to him about it and arguing back and forth, we finally got him to stay and to finish the week. So we finished the 1 week, and then we quit and went back to New York. But that was one instance where he didn't feel like playing because of that, because of not having drugs. But I would never have thought about, well, I'm going to go get him some drugs so he'll play. No way I'm going to do that. That's his life, and he can do what he wants with it.
You know, you said that the audience applauded when he said he didn't feel like playing.
Yeah, they did.
Do you think that the audience saw it not as a sign that he needed a fix, but rather as a sign of his, like, authenticity, that he played so much from the heart that if he wasn't feeling that impulse, then it just wasn't going to, like, measure up to his standard, and so he wouldn't play at all?
Well, I think it was more like that than about his habit.
Oh, okay.
They knew about his habit, or if they thought about that at all.
Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking about the recording that you made with Evans and LaFaro at the Village Vanguard, and shortly after you made that recording, Scott LaFaro died in a car accident.
You know, you want to hear about a dream I had after that?
After Scott LaFaro was killed?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
I was asleep, and it was the middle of the night, and the phone rings, and it's Bill Evans on the phone, and he says to me, Scott was just killed in a car crash. And I said, oh, okay, and I hung up and went back to bed. And then when I woke up in the morning, I thought I dreamed. I said, gee, I think Bill called me last night. So I called Bill again to see if it was true and everything, and it was. But that night I had a dream about Scott. And in the dream, we were in a room somewhere, and Scott is calling to me, and he said, hey, Paul, come over here. I want to show you something. Look out the window here. And it was amazing about his voice. He had a really distinctive voice, and it was so clear, and I was so sure it was him. And he wanted to show me something, and I walked over to the window, and that was the end of the dream. But I had that dream that same night.
So
it's pretty amazing.
When Evans first called you, you just went right back to sleep?
Yeah, I don't know what I thought. I thought I was, I didn't think it was real. I thought it was a dream or something. I just hung up and went back to sleep.
Later on, you started playing with the pianist Keith Jarrett, and you played with him for nearly 10 years?
I think so, yeah.
And
I met Keith, it must have been, I think it was in the late 60s. And I stayed with him till around 1976.
Now, you ended up buying his piano, and then you started taking piano and composition lessons.
True.
Where did you
find out all this stuff?
Oh, just reading up on you.
That's amazing. Wow. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
So this was, I guess, in the early 70s. What made you want to head in that direction of, like, learning piano and composition?
Well, ECM offered me a record date. And so I thought that I should write some music and learn how to compose and to write music and put a band together and do all those things. And I wanted to study the piano so I could be familiar with the piano so it would help me with composition. That's what happened.
Did it help you conceptualize music once you learn more about the keyboard, which is such a
sure.
great visual of all the instruments. It's like the clearest visual representation of melody and harmony. So was that helpful for you in thinking about writing?
Sure. Yeah, I think I love the piano. I think it's my favorite instrument, and I don't consider myself a pianist. I'm not really good at it, but by taking the lessons and learning a little bit. It really helped me.
As you look back on your career to date, is there any particular moment that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I'm proud of a lot of the music I've made with Bill Evans. And also some music with Keith Jarrett. There were some great moments there. And I'm proud of the fact that I'm able to still be around and be able to write music and get better at what I'm doing, and I feel like I'm still learning. Sometimes I feel like I'm still learning. I learned stuff. One day I was playing with some French musicians in Paris, and we were playing a ballad, and I started to think about what I was doing, and I realized that I was playing three different tempos on the drums against another tempo that was totally different that the other musicians were playing. And when I realized I was doing that, and I tried to figure it out, and as soon as I thought about it, it started to fall apart, so I stopped thinking about it and continued on. And that was amazing.
Is that the way you have to work, to like not think too hard about anything?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, just, you guys, I mean, at this point, I mean, I've been playing so long, I just I feel like I can just let it happen and do whatever I want, and everything will turn out okay.
Well, one more thing. You live in an apartment in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So how have you managed living in a Manhattan apartment all these years? How have you managed to practice drums?
Oh, I don't practice drums in there so much now, but I used to have rehearsals up there with Keith Jarrett. We used to rehearse there, and when I was first putting bands together, I rehearsed there and I played. And one time after playing, I was playing and practicing, and I got in the elevator, and it was this huge woman in the elevator. She must have been about 7 feet tall and weighed about 300 pounds. She looked at me, she said, "Is that you playing them drums?" And I said, "Oh, man, she's going to beat me up." And I said, "Yeah, I'm sorry." You know, she says, "Oh, well, keep it up. I like it. I like it." So that's how that went. I never had any complaints about playing drums in there.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, welcome.
Paul Motion speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. His latest recording is called Time and Time Again. Coming up, playwright Neil Simon. This is Fresh Air. There are two reasons our next visit is with playwright Neil Simon. One is that the TV series based on his hit Broadway comedy The Odd Couple was released this week on DVD. The 1970s series, starring Jack Klugman and Tony Randall as unlikely roommates, has been one of the most requested series not yet on DVD, so this should make a lot of people happy. And the other reason, by coincidence, is that today happens to be Jack Klugman's 85th birthday. Neil Simon started writing comedy for television in the 1950s on the classic Your Show of Shows with his brother Danny, who died in 2005. Neil shifted to writing Broadway plays and became a one-man comedy hit machine. Terry interviewed Neil Simon in 1996. Before we hear their conversation, here's a scene from the very first TV episode of The Odd Couple.
I'd like to look at your room, Oscar. Where'd you get all the laundry to do? Everything you own's on the floor.
These are my summer clothes. Sit down, Felix.
Where?
Under there, somewhere's a chair. Feel around.
I'll stand. Would you do me a favor?
What?
For my birthday, let me clean up in here.
No.
At least let me empty this great big
attic. That's my jewelry box. I like my room the way it is.
In my room, you can eat off the floor.
You can eat off the floor in my room. Hey, look, there's some crackers over there. And there's a half a tuna fish sandwich.
Why don't you eat it?
Let me ask you about creating two of your most famous characters, Felix and Oscar, the Odd Couple.
Yes.
How did you come up with those characters?
Well, I just watched it in real life. It was my brother, Danny, and a friend of his named Roy Gerber, both of whom moved in together in the same apartment because they recently were divorced. And they wanted to cut down on their expenses so they could help pay their alimony. And in their social life, rather than going out on a double date somewhere and spending a lot of money on the dinner, my brother Danny decided to cook. And Roy was kind of a, you know, things came and go very easily for him. So he would just say to the girls, come out for dinner. Come, you know, 6:30, 7, 7:30, whenever you're ready. Well, to Danny, that was anathema. I mean, He cooked the pot roast that night. He wanted them there at 7:30. And it was hilarious to me. And I said, Danny, this is a great movie, a great play, something. You must write it, because Danny was a writer too. But he never wrote by himself. And he started to write the play, but he took 3 months or so to write 10 pages and finally called me and he said, I can't do it. He says, I'm not a writer and I'm certainly not a playwright. He is a writer, of course, but he was not a playwright and he didn't know how to construct it. And he said, you take the play and you do it. And so I made a financial arrangement with him because it was his basic, it wasn't his idea to do it as a play, but it was his life, so I was taking a part of it. When I wrote the play in the beginning, I thought I was writing a very dark comedy. I didn't think it was going to be as funny as it was dark, because here was a man who was broken up with his wife that he loved dearly, and he had to leave his two children at home, and he was almost suicidal. Whereas Roy was another kind of character who was, I mean, the character that Roy was based on, the Oscar character, was a man who couldn't really keep his life going together, didn't know how to take care of his children's goldfish when they left. And so I thought I was writing, as I said, this grim comedy until I gave it to Bob Fosse, a good friend of mine who lived in the same building, to read. And he says, this is the funniest play I've ever read. And I said, you don't find it dark? And he said, no, not at all. So the author is not always sure about what impression he's going to leave when he writes this thing.
Now, how'd you feel about The Odd Couple when it became a TV series, where instead of like a constructed play every week, there was another little adventure or mishap to write
well,
around?
Well, I have to preface that by telling you the story, which you may have read in the book, that I had a business agent who thought he was doing me a favor by getting a deal made with Paramount Pictures, whereby they would buy this little company from me for $125,000, which seemed like an enormous amount of money, in which they got all of the TV and television rights to The Odd Couple. So I never saw a penny of any of The Odd Couple television series. So I could not watch that. I didn't watch that for 2 years, because when I saw that it was a hit, I saw that's my money going down their drain.
Right.
And so I looked at that as a very bad experience, and it was hard for me to watch the show until I finally did see it about 2 years after it was running, and I saw how good it was. It was really good. Didn't do me any good, but it's okay for them.
Oh, boy, what heartburn it must cost to feel that you almost don't want to see the success of your own work because you're not getting anything out of it.
I know. It was hard, but maybe just pushed me on to do other things, and I said, I've got to get on with this. I'm not going to sit and just gripe about it for the rest of my life, and I just went on to write other plays.
Early on in your career, your brother Danny was your writing partner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, what, about 8 years older?
Eight and a half years old, yes.
Yeah. And you write in your book that he was somewhere between your brother and your father. He was your mentor as well as your mm-hmm. brother. And your father actually was in and out of the family. He left the family and came back, I think, about eight times.
Exactly, yes.
Was it strange to have him coming and going like that, not knowing exactly what his relationship to you was?
It was awful, because I felt my life was sort of on a yo-yo, to give my kind of example. When he was gone, it was the most awful time, and I thought he was never coming back. And I'm sure a lot of my personality has been formed by that relationship, and it makes me somewhat insecure at times. And it's why I think I fell back on writing, possibly, as a way of being able to support and survive for myself.
I imagine your mother, when your father was gone, ended up very busy with earning money to take care of the family. And
yes, she was uneducated. Mm-hmm. She did not have a job, and she would do whatever she could to provide for us. She borrowed from her family, but what she eventually did, which was the hardest thing for us, was she took in two men to live in our house, two boarders, who took her bedroom, and she slept on the sofa in the living room. My brother and I had our own bedroom. And they were butchers, and they paid us mostly in meat and lamb chops. it was no fun sitting at the room in the kitchen eating with them.
Why not?
They were like strangers. They didn't talk to us. They were mostly foreigners, and I don't mean mostly foreigners. They were foreign and spoke some English, but it was difficult, and it was not my father, and I felt I was living in not my house, but their house.
You know, the stereotype of the Jewish mother of your mother's generation was of the overly possessive, overly neurotic Jewish mother, right? I imagine your mother was much too busy.
She was.
To fit that stereotype at all.
No, I don't think she did fit that stereotype. She was very different. She was very loving and very encouraging in terms of my brother and I doing the writing. My brother, foolishly, I think, would read the monologues that we would write at first to my mother, and she would just laugh all the way through. And my brother said, "Do you understand what they mean?" And she said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Well, why are you laughing?" She says, "Well, it pleases me to please you." I mean, it was such a wonderful thing for her to do. It didn't encourage us as writers, but it encouraged us that we had a terrific mother.
Neil Simon speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. The first season of his TV series, The Odd Couple, has just been released on DVD. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film from French film director Alain René. This is Fresh Air. The 84-year-old French filmmaker Alain René is best known for his many non-linear art films, such as Hiroshima Mon Amour and Last Year at Marienbad. 20 years ago, he began adapting plays. His latest film, Private Fears in Public Places, is based on a play by the British writer Alan Ackburn. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Before I tell you about Alain René's newest masterpiece, I want to say a word about formalism and what is sometimes called slanderously style over substance. In great cinema, there's no divide. The way the camera moves through space, how characters are framed in relation to one another and the world, the palette, the rhythms of the editing, they're not extrinsic to a movie's meaning. In Private Fears in Public Places, known in France as Cours or Hearts, they are the meaning. René's film is a veritable essay in space and color. More important, it's a film in which those elements mirror the psychological space, the emotional color of a bunch of deeply screwed up people. This isn't the elliptical René of his seminal fractured memory films, Hiroshima Mon Amour and Last Year at Marienbad. Private Fears in Public Places isn't difficult. It's fluid, teasing, light on its feet. It's positively yummy. It's transcendentally yummy. It's based on a play by Alan Ayckbourn, an Englishman who knows his way around farce, but has lately edged into more grown-up forms of sex comedy, or in this case, sex comedy without actual sex. René has moved the story to Paris, where it unfolds against a gentle snowstorm. He uses a curtain of falling snow to break up every scene. This is a movie with many curtains. René frames his characters through doorways and windows and cubicles and anything that makes physical the forces that keep people separate. Yet the film is never claustrophobic. The camera's drift creates layers of space, each character in his or her own little universe. As the title suggests, the main characters could hardly be more walled off. The movie opens with Laura Morant as a woman searching for an apartment to move into with her fiancé, played by Lambert Wilson. But the one she's shown by realtor André Dussolier, she finds clumsily subdivided. The camera gazes down on the maze of little rooms from overhead, a perfect visual correlative for the movie to come. The interiors are all creamy pastels. The critic Armand White describes them in pastry terms as glaçaed. But the extreme stylization has the effect of bringing the characters closer to us, since even at their most foolish, they're on the same color spectrum. The narrative baton is passed from lonely soul to lonely soul. The fiancé, Lambert Wilson, fastens himself to a bar stool in a candy-colored basement hotel bar, anything to keep from facing the woman he's supposed to marry. Back in the realtor's office, the older man gazes longingly at his radiantly tousled assistant, played by Sabine Azima, who gives him inspirational videotapes. They show her devout religious side, but when the pious programming runs out, there's a blizzard of video snow and then a hot babe, maybe her, doing a striptease. While the realtor stares at this homemade porn loop, his lonely heart sister, Isabel Carré, ends up on a blind date at that bar with Wilson. And on the carousel goes. There are many crisscrosses in private fears in public places, laborious to describe, but marvelously easy to watch. The 84-year-old director has stripped the movie down to pure elegance. It's not reductionist. It's about human beings trying to reach out from their own private spaces. And for two sublime hours, it's all we need of the world. I urge you to see it on a big screen, but if it doesn't show up at your local art house, you have another option. Its distributor, the Independent Film Channel, is offering the film as a pay-per-view on many cable systems. I believe in seeing movies at theaters, but in a pinch, private fears in public places may be consumed without fear, in private.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Bonterra Vineyards, Mendocino, California. Fine wines made with organically grown grapes and respect for the earth. Bonterra promotes responsible drinking. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Matthew Perry. He's starring in the new film Numb. And actress Sarah Polley. She's making her directorial debut with the film Away From Her, based on a short story by Alice Munro. It stars Julie Christie as a woman with Alzheimer's. Join us for the next Fresh Air.